I just started. This is an interview with Ruben Lorenz on the 31st of August, 1984. We're interviewing in his office in the credit union. And I am Laura Smale. The interview is being done for the University Archives Oral History Project. I'd like to, you have some notes written down there. You have some comments or some things that you are going to discuss to begin with.
Yeah, I think that possibly one place to start would be the merger of the University of Wisconsin system with the state university system, which went into law in 1971. Just recently, within the past year, the Legislative Audit Bureau was making a survey of system administration, and they thought the appropriate starting point would be to look over all of the research papers that were done in preparation for merger. And when they were informed that there was no study made prior to merger of the impact of merger, that it was strictly a political decision, they were quite surprised at it. Because, you know, the this was Pat Lucey's idea to merge higher education, and he was successful in getting it through the legislature, and there was never any detailed analysis made of the cost effectiveness or anything like that, or what the impact would be on higher education in the state. It was a political decision all the way, and really the research type input into the decision was almost non-existent. Of course, it grew out of great discontent with the coordinating council and the coordinating commission, which was really very ineffective in administering higher education in Wisconsin. But they did make a lot of enrollment projections and try to put together a consolidated budget for presentation to the legislature, but their input into the budget was very ineffective. I can recall a meeting of the Coordinating Council at the Wisconsin Center Building, and it was a budget discussion where the coordinating group was trying to reduce some of the input from the University of Wisconsin at that particular time, and Irv Shane made a presentation to the commission, and in about a 10-minute presentation, he completely destroyed the staff, coordinating commission staff's documentation and their position, and the board, the coordinating board, actually voted against their staff on that particular thing, and that was the beginning of the end. That apparently that must have been in 1970, probably, or in the spring of 71, maybe, but probably in the spring of 71, because that was word, of course, got out in that particular split between the board and the staff, and when it went to the legislature, it was the same reaction as had been demonstrated at the Wisconsin Center Building. So that was really the last presentation that they did take to the legislature, because they were voted out of existence at that in that session. But I was really very impressed with Irv Shane, who I assume at that time was vice chancellor of the Madison campus, and it was just a one of the most concise, articulate presentations I'd ever heard, and it was very, no, it was not an impassioned plea or anything like this. It was just a statement of fact, going right bang, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, carrying it through, and demonstrating the inaccuracies and the lack of support that the staff of the coordinating commission had put into their document, and Irving has always continued to be a very, very good speaker. When he makes up his mind to take a position on something, he does his homework extremely well, and his presentations are usually concise and to the point, and well documented, and very effective. And I've always respected her for his great ability in this area to make effective presentations to whatever group it is, whether it's the regents or legislators or whoever it is.
Whom would he have worked with on this?
I would guess in this particular one that he did most of his homework himself. Sure, he worked with the budget staff, but Irv has always known the Madison campus budget from the time he was vice chancellor up right up through the now, and he's chancellor. He still knows that budget inside out. And I would say, if anything, that's one of Irv's shortcomings is his failure to probably delegate as much as he should in some of these areas. But he understands the budget very, very well, and he has a very good feel for it. And I would think on this particular one, he'd probably work with his budget staff on the campus. Don't know if Glenn Watts was there at that time or not. Probably not. But I'm sure that Irv did an awful lot of the work himself on it, and he was well prepared.
What was your position at that time?
I think that I, not sure if I was associate vice president or vice president at the time. I was probably vice president at that time. And I was at the meeting, and that's it. We had worked with the coordinating people also, and of course, we did work with Madison and acquaint them with the facts of what was in the budget and everything like that. But we were on the same wavelength as Irv was on it. But he did the actual presentation.
In other words, you also felt that it was not a...
Yeah. We did not have a high regard or respect for most of the staff work which had been done by the coordinating commission. It is very difficult for people like that, whether they are a commission that is that far removed from the actual university, or whether it's a analyst at the Department of Administration or the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, even if they're very capable individuals, they're so far removed from the work that is going on that it is hard for them to have the same feel for what the objectives are and what the missions are and hoped for accomplishments are. You can't really do it as well when you're that far removed from it as the professionals within the university itself, because they just have a better feel for it. And I think this is one of the difficulties that system administration has had since merger, going right into it now. The ongoing interface on budget matters with the legislature and the state executive branch is from system administration. And again, that they all have a lot of history in working with the university. They are not novices in the area or anything like that, but in instances, again, they are one step removed from the firing line of the research and extension and so on, which is being done at the various institutions of the system. And I think that it does detract from the effectiveness sometimes of the presentations, because you can't feel it as much. You know, if you really feel something and you've been deeply involved in it, it's a lot easier to make an impassioned plea for support. But if you're standing back and have more of an unbiased position, it's a little hard to be as effective in the presentations. But the once the legislature voted for merger, the first board meetings was a combined board meeting of the full boards from the University of Wisconsin and the state universities. And the university board was 10 members at that time, 9 appointed members, each one for a 9-year term. So one terminated, one term expired each year, and then the state superintendent of public instruction. I'm not sure the size of the state universities, but it was comparable. It was also a relatively small board. So then the legislation provided that the two boards would, all of them would retain their positions, but as their terms expired, the board would become smaller. I think it added to the board the president of the board of the vocational technical system. That was an additional member besides the superintendent. So there was eventually there would be the 16-member board, which we currently have, which is a 14 appointed ones of 7 years each, with two terms expiring each year, and then the two ex officio, the superintendent of public instruction and the president of the board of the vocational technical system.
That's still a pretty big board, isn't it?
Yes, it's too large a board. 16 is too many on the board. It would be much better if it were in the 10 area, you know, or somewhere between 8 and 12, somewhere in that area. It would be, I think, a much better board, because that way each member who is appointed would feel the burden of responsibility to do their homework, and also it would be small enough so that the administration could get to know the members of the board and could work better together as a team. With 16 members, why, it's too large for either of those things to take place. And most regions are very diligent in doing their work, but there are always some that for various reasons probably don't have the time or the desire to really do all of the work that should be done as a good regent. And it's a very sought after appointment, the most sought after, I understand, of any appointments the governor makes is to be on the board. Why, I don't know, because I remember Joyce Erdman saying one time that she was a 7-year term on the board and was president of the board, first woman president of the board, as I recall. And she kiddingly said that she heard before, when she was considering it, that it was a position of great prestige and not too much work. And she found out after she was on the board that it was just the opposite, that a tremendous amount of work and prestige was pretty well forgotten. Oh, I think that there is a certain amount of prestige that goes with it there. And almost invariably, the people who once serve on the board are very disappointed if they're not reappointed.
Reappointed.
They really want to stay on the board. They really do. And some of them are almost bitter about not being reappointed. You know, they apparently really enjoy being a regent.
How long is the term now?
7 years. They're on for 7 years now. Mm. And but they would like to stay longer. Apparently really enjoy it.
And who's responsible for deciding how big it is?
That's set in the statutes. When the merger legislation was drawn, Chapter 36 of the statutes, which was the governing section of the University of Wisconsin before, was completely redrafted.
This is the Merger Implementation
Merger
Committee
Implementation
that did that?
Merger Committee did that, and that consisted of regents, legislators, even had students on it and some staff on it. And I remember Clara Penniman, Jack Pelosek, Clara Penniman, of course, from the Economics Department. Jack Pelosek was the president of the board. I think he was president of the board at that time, or else he was right after that. He was probably after that, but anyway, he was very active in it. He was a lawyer from Milwaukee. I forget who the other regents were, but Don Percy was on it representing administration. And I think one of the, I think Chuck Stathis, he may have worked with the, I don't know if he was a member of the committee or not, but he was the legal staff anyway, and I know he worked a lot on it. And there was even student representation. Uh-huh. Well, so it was a fairly large group, and apparently they did a pretty good job on it, because it hasn't been amended that much since it was written. but it lays out the responsibilities and of the faculty and the administration and the students, and they're all spelled out in it pretty well.
Did you go to the meetings?
I think I went to about one meeting as all, because you know they were very lengthy meetings, and we had certain things which we wanted in there.
We being?
And primarily, well, the business side of the administration. Was really the language dealing with the appropriations primarily, and with the auxiliaries and some things like that, and I think all of those things were incorporated into the final, because we have done very little in amending the rules and the statutes, Chapter 36.
Was this something that you worked on yourself, what you thought ought to be?
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, we'd...
I mean, you
yes,
personally?
I personally worked on the language, and I've always done that. Every year we look through the language and see if there are any things we want changed, and now I've done that probably for 20 years at personally would review the appropriation language and other aspects of the statutes which would deal with appropriation to find out if we want changes. And this past year we changed the amount of the contingent fund, for instance, which is part of, I think that's under Chapter 20, which is the appropriation section dealing with university. And so we get changes, and then we develop our own wording, and I've done a lot of that myself, and if I didn't actually write the wording, I always checked it very carefully and reviewed it and pretty much directed what the wording should say, try to say anyway. And sometimes we've had legal people actually do some of the drafting, but I've always, yes, I did that for probably at least 20 years that I personally involved in the statutory language dealing with appropriations.
Were there any provisions that you wanted to get into that original document that they didn't want to put in for any reason?
I can't remember that there were anything that was really left out which should have been in there.
So it wasn't a controversial, you weren't dealing with
no
controversial matters?
No. One of the things which came about at the same time, which I think was a mistake and has created problems, was the development of salary ranges for state executives. And it included in the, it's under 20.923 section of the statutes, as I recall, and it places the university president, vice presidents, chancellors, and some of the vice chancellors into specific ranges, and then lists a large number of other people who are vice presidents, vice chancellors, or directors who have that in their title, and places a limitation on their salary as well relating to those that are in the executive pay plan. And that has created a situation where deans, for instance, and professors who are not included on there are now getting higher salaries than the president and the chancellor and some of the rest of them. It's caused a very bad compression, and it's making it very difficult to get administrators, and not only in the academic area but in some of the other areas as well, such as a hospital and some places like that. They've fallen far behind what their counterparts are making in other parts of the country. So it's I think that was a mistake, and I don't know if that happened at the exact time of the merger legislation or if it was in the next session, but it was right in the early 70s anyway that took place, and I think that has been a bad thing for the university.
It's interesting to have you say that, because everybody's worrying about faculty salaries, and everybody always thinks administrators are paid too much,
right.
But and evidently there hasn't been a push to change this.
Well, see, it's
it wouldn't look well, I suppose.
Yeah, see, it, normally the presentations to the legislature and executive branch are done by administrators.
Yeah.
And so it looks very self-serving to have them make the presentation. And so there has been some effort lately of regents to do it. So it really should come from regents, because it's not self-serving for them to do it, but it is for the president or vice presidents or anybody like that, because they're all included in the listing. But comparisons which we did the last year or so in the executive salaries with other institutions, you know, we've fallen so far behind the other Big Ten institutions, for instance, that it's if you really had to go out and hire people now, you'd find it very difficult to get the top people at the top positions, because of the, well, even in my replacement, you know, a number of very promising candidates turned the position down for my replacement strictly because of salary. You know, they have to take a $20,000 reduction to come here, and from a smaller institution, and that just once they found out the salary, they weren't interested anymore.
Have there been other cases earlier of people you wanted that you couldn't get? You're talking about the top administrators and also chancellors, is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I don't know of the specifics, but I would guess that that some of the chancellors or people we would have liked to have had for chancellors just failed to even respond because of the low salaries that they would receive here compared to what they were already making at some other institution. Even as a faculty person, they would be making more probably than the chancellors would be making here.
This presumably wasn't so much a problem right at the beginning.
That's
right. Is that right?
That's right. At the beginning, you had a some spread anyway. See, it was tied, the top range 10 of the executive one was the governor and the president of the university. And so nobody could make more than the governor.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, the governor in some cases declined increases and the legislature didn't give him increases. So then you got that real compression. So nothing below him would move either then, or they'd move maybe 1 or 2 or 3% or something like that. And the fact they get a 6% raise, and these would get, you know, the ranges would move 3%. So you were automatically getting more and more compression there. And it's a position now where faculty and deans particularly have moved well ahead of the top administrators.
Are there ways of getting around that, such as offering somebody lots more household money? Or?
No, there are no perks. Really, the only people who get any perks in the system at all outside of the normal faculty are the president and the chancellors. None of the other executives receive anything other than the teaching faculty person or the janitor. That they get the same insurance, the same retirements, and they do get a retirement benefit. They put more into retirement benefit than the and the retirement benefits are a little different formula. Well, this is kind of wandering around
yes.
here.
That was interesting as an example of something you thought was not a good idea. Is there anything else you can think of?
Well, that was the main one. I think by and large that merger has come off a lot better than anybody really had a right to expect that it would. I think it's worked pretty well. Sure, there have been shortcomings, and a lot of people in Madison probably feel they would have done better without merger, but I'm not personally convinced that that's true. The 70s, the late 60s and early 70s, with all the student disruptions, was the end of the golden era for higher education, at least as far as Wisconsin was concerned. Wisconsin historically has supported the university very well. And there have been comments periodically about the large number of non-residents and whether we should be using state tax dollars to to finance education of the people. They also referred particularly to New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts with them. But most of our non-residents do come from Illinois. Many more come from Illinois than any other state, and it's always been that way. But the student disruptions of the late 60s and into 1970 turned a lot of people off on higher education. And you know, the evidence was too obvious in Madison itself. If the Capitol would have been in Milwaukee or someplace, it probably wouldn't have had quite the impact. But with the all the windows smashed on State Street and University Avenue and the destruction of buildings and so on, it was very obvious that there was a distasteful part of the whole situation which the students were leading. And a lot of them were students. They weren't all students, but an awful lot of them were students.
You had firsthand evidence of this. Did your job involve talking to legislators? And
I've on occasion talked to legislators, but I was never a liaison person, direct liaison person. At one time in the 60s there, I handled the building program, so I worked with the building commission, which is legislators, and Jerry Leonard was chairman of the university subcommittee, and so
you worked with him, did you?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I was trying to think of what his, Paul DeMore was his assistant at that time, and so before the meetings and everything, you know, we'd have to have everything cleared with Paul, and then we'd have a short meeting with Jerry Leonard, who was chairman of the commission dealing with higher education. So Jerry was very good to work with, a very bright person, extremely bright person. I thought a good legislator overall. And we got an awful lot of construction done at the university while he was in charge of that. And he was interesting to work with, and I found him supportive.
You can track down a story. I've heard that he's the one who was responsible for adding the story, the additional stories to Van Hise.
Well, he was certainly involved in the discussions, because that was the time he was on the building commission, he would have been. I don't know if he was responsible for it. I think Fred Harrington was really responsible for it.
You do?
I think so. Because looking at that building in the middle of the campus, and I recall Fred talking about that, it was a shame to not go higher on that, and it would be a good place for the system offices to be there to take them out of Bascom and to put them on this particular building.
You actually heard him say that?
I can't recall. I really can't recall definitely that I heard him, but there was a type of discussion that was going on anyway, so I think Fred Harrington had probably more to do with that than anybody else. Now, whether he created the idea or initiated the idea or not, but he became very supportive of it, the concept anyway. And I think it's probably worked out very well, except the elevators are still built for that many additional floors on it. It's worked out well for system. I think it's better to have system located there than to have them located in a downtown office building, which I opposed, and that came up.
Oh, I see. That was
at the time of merger. The state university's major office was on East Gilman Street, right close to where the barracks building is. In fact, I don't know if that was torn down for the barracks building or not.
Let's stop now. All right.
See, the University of Wisconsin system had been moved into Van Hise before merger. We moved in there in 1969, which is a couple of years before merger. And the state university has had their offices on East Gilman Street. There was discussion, of course, where it should be located after merger, and whether it should be on East Gilman or whether it should be someplace else. And there was talk about having another office building around town and everything like that. But the Van Hise had the boardroom there and everything, and good setup for Regent Records and so on, which lent itself to having the board there, and then that led to having some of the top executive offices there as well. And I think that was a good move, because if you move away from a campus, you're even further removed, as I mentioned earlier, carrying forward the message from the institutions is hard to do if you're not a part of the institution. And if you're located at a off-campus area completely, you're again one step further removed. System administration does have offices off away from their course. It does have the offices on Monroe Street, and I think that is partly an example of how not to do things. That the fragmentation of system administration is not good for system administration offices. You know, there are some located in the Wharf Building, some on two different buildings on Monroe Street, some at 905 University Avenue, some in the A.W. Peterson mm-hmm. Building, some in Van Hise.
That's just lack of space in Van Hise.
Yeah. But I think that most of those are close enough to the campus that they're part of the campus life, but the Monroe Street ones are a little too far removed, and I think that some of the good interaction that should take place is missing from some of the offices that are over there. They tend to become a little too isolated.
But the state colleges must have fought the idea of having it on the Madison campus.
Well, yes, there was early pressure to have it located in some neutral spot. And feeling that Madison would certainly be the recipient of special favors all along the line by having it located in the middle of the Madison campus. I don't think that has really been the case. I think that the top administration has tried to be extremely fair in giving Madison what it should have gotten, and but yet that also treating all of the other institutions the same way, if they really deserve something and could give a good case for it, that they should be treated as well. And
what made them capitulate?
Well, the Regents just decided that was it, and there.
Oh, I see.
And really was never negotiated.
I see.
And.
This got off from a question I had asked you as to whether you had any personal evidence of how the state was affected by the protest. That is, whether you were dealing with legislators or mm-hmm. some things came up in connection with the business affairs that made you actively aware of this.
I guess I can't think of any specific item, but it you know, at the hearings and joint finance and so on, there would be, you know, snide remarks made and this type of thing. It was I think if you look through them,
you went to those.
Yes, I usually went to the joint finance mm-hmm. meetings and was not the presenter, but would be available for questions backup support, usually the formal presentations to joint finance historically have been handled by the president and the chairman of the board. And then they may call upon other people for specific things, but the formal presentations are usually handled by the president. And with varying levels of success. The merger, John Weaver didn't come to Wisconsin to be president of a system. He came to be president of the Madison campus.
Yes.
And there was Milwaukee in that involved, mm-hmm. but basically his love was Madison. Mm-hmm. And his father had been on the faculty for 40-some years, and the speech department in Madison, and John had lived in Madison, gotten you know, at least some of his degrees in Madison, and really loved Madison. So he didn't support merger before it happened, and so on. But I give him a lot of credit for really pulling it off pretty well, bringing the two different factions into one operation and doing it with a minimum of real friction and developing a quite successful system administration. I think probably the most successful of any in the country, as far as analysis work and detailed budgeting and so on. And the overall administration of it, I think, is probably, I don't think a question about it, but best in the country. And he did it by hiring good people. He hired Don Percy and Don Smith. To start with, right after merger, Leonard Haas was the executive vice president, who had been working for a short time in the State University Board Office on leave from his being president at Eau Claire. And so he worked for a year or two as executive vice president in system administration, and never really felt comfortable in that role.
Why not?
Well, he loved Eau Claire, and he loved being head of the Eau Claire campus, and he related so well to that area that I think that his relationship with Madison and Milwaukee was never quite as professional as it probably should have been. I think he was awed is not the right word, but I think he was had somewhat of a feeling that his role in life was different than that. So he didn't last too long before he wanted to beg to get out of it and go back to Eau Claire.
Oh.
And probably a year and a half or something like that, he was in that role.
What year? Is this from 1972 on?
Right. Mm-hmm. 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 And then that's when Weaver brought in Don Smith then to replace him.
Was Weaver having the kind of cabinet meetings that I've heard Fred Harrington had?
Weaver's cabinet was, through most of his career, was he and Don Smith and Don Percy.
Not you.
I was in that part of the troika.
Hmm. Even, what about when Haas was there?
I would say there was more involvement, probably when Haas was there, I had more involvement in. Leonard is just a wonderful man. I don't think you'll ever find a nicer person than Leonard Haas. He no Claire area is idolized, I guess you might say, as far as that whole campus community is concerned. Mm. Just. So I was glad when he and I encouraged him to go back to Eau Claire, because you knew that he'd do this as a favor to the university and to Weaver and this type of thing, but you could tell it wasn't his first love, and it was good for him to go back to Eau Claire.
So he presumably wasn't much help to Weaver at that time.
Not as much. I would say his help was more in pacifying the what were then previously president and chancellors of all of the state university system.
And that needed doing.
Especially those first few years. And then there was quite a bit of turnover of chancellors, but especially for those that stayed on, you know, they wanted to have a spokesman and very high in the system. So So he was really their leader in system administration, and then Don Percy was supposedly the leader from Madison, Milwaukee, and so on. Uh-huh. And so the two of them were senior vice presidents under him. And then when Haas left, Don Smith came in.
And did he become the spokesman for the other campuses?
Well, no. By that time, a lot of this has gone away, you know, and in a couple of years that kind of disappeared, that they felt they could still go directly to the president and this type of thing. And they would get a sympathetic ear from whoever was there. And see, Don Smith didn't have the, he came from Minnesota. I think he got his PhD, I think, from Wisconsin, but Madison, but he didn't have that same strong tie that some other people would have had if they would have stayed there.
Did you think he was a good choice, Smith?
Oh, yes, excellent choice. Just excellent, yeah. Don Smith is a joy to work with, you know, and is a
How?
Very articulate person. He has a good understanding of finance and knows what higher education is all about. Easygoing, but a man with a prodigious worker. That's output, you know, is just fantastic. And Don Percy is the same way, you know, extremely bright and just worked, you know, 15 hours a day, you know, and just turned out reams and reams of stuff, you know. Of course, a lot of this required a lot of extra work from all the institutions, too. And so there was a period there when trying to set up a central data bank and this type of thing, where there was an awful lot of work required of the institutions, which had never been done before, as far as data on budgeting staff and students and so on, more so than in the pure finance area. So they were, in some respects, not too unhappy when Don left, I think, to go to Health and Social Services, because they knew there would be somewhat of a reduction in their normal paperwork requirements.
Was it too much, do you think?
What?
Do you think it was too much?
Yeah, it was too much, I think.
That he asked of them?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of it had to be done to set up a system. And there wasn't any question about it that, as I said earlier, we have the best one in the country, and a lot of it's due to Don's insistence that they get set up a good database in system administration.
Why do you say we have the best in the country? How do you know that?
Well, I think we have set up systems to accumulate more data, which is relevant to the management of the institutions.
Hmm.
And I think that...
how do you judge something like that?
Well, it's... subjective, of course, and I'm sure I'm biased on it, but I do know an awful lot of other people in system offices around the country, and what information you can get from them, what information they have, such as at SUNY and California and Texas, uh-huh. And Missouri. One that I don't know enough about to really judge would be North Carolina, which I think is probably the closest. And I think North Carolina has a pretty aggressive system. So,
and did Don Percy develop this? Or?
He did a lot of it. He did an awful lot of it, yeah. We did, in the finance area, we did it. And we had excellent finance data that we could pull off from all the
So system. You were doing some of this, too?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Was it part of your job to get
the
financial data from you?
We started that right at the time of merger. We brought in some working groups, and even before the first budget was out, we pretty much set up a classification of accounts for all of the accounting records, and established what our levels of control would be at the system office, and what records would have to be kept at the institution level.
Was this difficult? Did you have to make it up yourself?
Well, we lifted an awful lot of it from the University of Wisconsin system. An awful lot of it was lifted from there.
Mm. You mean the plan, the
right.
structure of it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we, and because we did have a very good system going there, and so we lifted an awful lot of it, and the others were just brought into it, and A minimum of kicking and screaming, but that no, they there was not. We really didn't have any problems of bringing them along. There's some recalcitrants, as I suppose you would say, along the line, who still don't do things the way we'd like to have them do things. But it was a very cooperative effort all the way down, up and down the line, and it's been interesting. Since merger, the business people have always gotten together a couple of times, two or three times a year, at least twice a year. And the first few years, you know, it was a lot of you and us, that the two systems still stayed pretty much amongst themselves, you know. But as the years have gone by, that now you go to a meeting, you wouldn't even know which what the background was anymore, because there's absolutely no carryover of that type of feeling now. And,
well, it seems to me there must have been several groups. It'd be Madison by itself, presumably always sort of setting itself apart from the others, and then the colleges that have been state colleges, and there would be the system, the Milwaukee and Green Bay. Is that right? And then there would be your top structure.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, how are the alliances?
Well, the first alliances were, bringing in of Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Parkside with Madison. You know, that had been resolved earlier because that had kind of evolved into eighth.
But Madison was never entirely comfortable about that.
Well, but relatively speaking, they weren't. Certain parts of it were unhappy. I think there was one time there that a certain amount of wharf money went to Milwaukee under Fred's insistence. That's Fred Harrington's insistence. And Madison was never very comfortable with that, which has been reversed. You know, after merger, that was reversed over a period of years, and that support was phased down. And I think there was some thought that maybe too much money went to Parkside and Green Bay, the new campuses, which Madison maybe should have gotten. But that was done during the 60s, and money was flowing pretty well at that time. So there wasn't much of a feeling of antagonism towards Green Bay or Parkside or Milwaukee. I think that was part of the family. But then at the time of the other major merger, well, then you brought in all of these from the other state universities, and which was a large group that you brought in at one time, and most of them didn't know each other.
Uh-huh.
And so it took a number of years to meld together, and it did work very well in the business area. It worked very well. And it's worked very well on the vice chancellor's level and in the academic area as well. So.
Did you make any mistakes? I mean, were there data that you didn't get that you should have?
Well, we never made any mistakes.
Well, that's good.
Oh, I'm sure we made mistakes. I mean, I don't really recall any major snafus on it. One of the things which we put in, I suppose, when was Dreyfus elected governor? 76, was that? Yeah, it must have been 7, or was it 78?
Goodness.
Whenever it was, anyway.
I can't remember.
No, we had a budget control system around the system, you know, and each institution was expected to stay within its budget. If you had slight variations on it, you didn't do anything about it. And just about a year or so before Dreyfus was elected, both La Crosse and Stevens Point ran over their budget in the neighborhood of $100,000. And of course, we couldn't tolerate that, so we just reduced their next year's appropriation by that amount. And I think it was a testing of system administration to see if system administration would actually do it. And we did it, there were never any complaints about it. But since then, we've always done it. You know, even if it's a small amount that anybody runs over their budget, well, we just take it out of their next year's budget. So it was a type of control which we didn't like to exercise, because we like to give them, you know, they're responsible individuals, and you live by what you do on it, so that they should take care of themselves. But the big ones like that, which appeared to be more deliberate, so they just paid the price of it the next year. And so interesting meeting we had with the board was shortly after merger. It was at Platteville, and at that time we had a lot of empty dormitories. Mm-hmm. And Doug Osterheld, who was the head of our auxiliary operations, was very creative in coming up with ideas to salvage the dormitory operation and make it a working operation with manager feeling of satisfaction and so on. And we were brought in the auxiliary budget, and I remember Regent Levine particularly thought that we should be reducing the prices substantially so that we'd get more occupants in the dormitories. Instead, we were increasing the rates in the dormitories because none of the state university system had any money in there for repairs, or if the roof leaked or something, where they'd have to have almost a special assessment to repair the roof. And no reserves for maintenance or anything like that. And so we were insisting that they put in a reserve requirement to pick up past failures by putting in more than the normal reserve requirements for the first years anyway, until it built up. And Levine said we should go the other way, that we should reduce rates. And then we tried to show them that how many additional students you'd have to get for even a small reduction, because and a small reduction wouldn't affect the demand. And it wasn't that elastic anyway, so unless you made a major reduction of hundreds of dollars before it would impact it. And but we went on for quite a while, quite a heated discussion, and so finally other regions convinced him to back down, and they supported us. And we have found that not only the next year, that we had more occupants the next year and more the next year, until we were overflowing at just about every place in the system except Oshkosh and Superior, and found out that the demand was not really based upon price. That it was more upon the environment and upon the environment of the times.
Yeah.
It had a lot more to do with it than a few hundred dollars in the pricing structure.
Which you couldn't possibly predict the way you can enrollment, could
that's
you?
Yeah. And but I remember that was one of the more heated discussions in the board meeting of any particular issue, which was an interesting one. And now the dormitories are all extremely healthy. They all have very substantial reserves. You need a roof repair or new carpeting or new drapes, they got the money to do it. And some of the chancellors were on Levine's side, and he may have been prompted by some of them at that time to keep the prices down, because the old state university philosophy was to build cheap dormitories and keep the price very low. Uh-huh. In doing so, they ran them into the ground, and time of merger, there was actually $1,600,000 deficit in the residence halls of the ones we took over. Now we have $100 million that we invest for.
What'd you do about that deficit?
Well, a variety of different practices. They were all, the state universities were in a pooling system. Their dormitories were built out of for those, all those institutions. So we set up a plan for those that were in the hole for a payback But if they would pay it back, well, then we would take out of the pool half of it, and each institution would only pay back half of it. And so then we set the money aside, and we invested the money that we were accumulating for reserves, and then we would use the interest earnings on that for the first few years and would put that back to cover the deficit. So we.
Whose idea was that?
Most of it was Doug Osterheld. I say he was very creative in ideas. Another good idea he had was that for the dormitories that declared surplus space, they're going to not use this building this year, then we would not charge them any debt service for those beds that they declared surplus, which again would be collected from the entire pool, and we would take enough money off the interest earnings to pay that debt service directly from the system-wide pool. So if the manager, I mean, if the dormitory manager didn't have that, there's no way he could make money. He was just in a catch-22 situation. And so this way he would have incentives to operate those that he was operating and do them well and make money and so on. And it really created a very improved morale amongst the auxiliary managers, because now they could look at the thing and they could manage to a profit or to a break-even point and all. And so it was a very, very positive impact on them. Also came up with the idea that no student at any institution should have to pay more than $55 for debt service for a student center, gymnasium, or football, whatever it was, out of their segregated fees. And Superior is the only one now that is in that situation. So they get subsidized then from the interest earnings from the total pooled reserves. Because otherwise each student up there would be paying $100 for debt service on their student center and on their Westman Arena, whereas in Madison it would be probably $15. And so it would be, you know, it would really work to their hardship to put together any kind of a student activity program and this type of thing if you had that much debt service. It would drive their fees up higher than any place else by a substantial amount. So again, this has worked very well, and there was, I say, opposition from some of the campuses along the lines of these things, because these were revolutionary ideas and where the has would be doing something to support the have-nots. But now there's enough money, so about the only thing that comes off now, there's a little skim there for the dormitory and student center relief at Superior. The rest are all on their own.
This is tape two of the interview with Ruben Lorenz. Do you want to carry? You were in the middle of a statement.
Yeah, just talking about the auxiliaries, which was a major part of the merger situation. So it's all related to merger and how the system has evolved since 1971. And again, now the dormitories at Eau Claire and River Falls are as healthy as those are in Madison, which wasn't the situation at the earlier on. And now the interest earnings of any of their reserves go back to the institution which generates them. So the auxiliaries has been a very positive thing and since merger for most of the institutions and are now in just excellent shape.
Are there other examples like that you can think of? I mean, dormitories is one. Is there any?
Well, a similar situation was true of the student centers. They're pretty
much
the student, same.
But anything connected with the?
Well, the buildings are probably a somewhat different situation. They are, of course, supported by tax monies, and freedom to do much about it is more at the hands of the building commission than it was in the auxiliary.
So there wasn't room for the creative thinking.
That's right. Yeah,
I see.
That's much more rigid. In Can't think of too much else on merger. I do think that Madison probably did not get hurt as much as I think it would, because coming into merger, there was a open hostilities between the two systems in trying to get money from the legislature. McPhee was a very shrewd politician and was quite successful in getting money for the state universities. Time of merger, of course, so then it went in as one budget, and the salaries at the other institutions gained on the doctoral campuses, Madison, Milwaukee. However, that was already taking place before merger, because there was a couple of years where there were legislatively mandated increases at a higher level at the state universities and where Madison and Milwaukee. This was an emphasis on teaching.
Oh yes, that was David Adamany, is that right?
Could well be.
That was his big push.
Yeah, so that did take place there.
Did you know him?
I didn't know him very well when he's here. I've met him several times since he's left here. He's at Detroit now, University of Detroit. And if he can pull that one off there and make a, it's a Wayne Stadium, Wayne State in Detroit. If he can pull that one off and get a great institution out of that, he's going to deserve a lot of credit, because that's a tough place to put and try to develop a major institution there. It's a lot of night courses, and it's not in the most desirable area, and has always been the third on the totem pole behind Michigan and Michigan State. So it's he's got a tough road to hoe there.
Do you think he was chiefly responsible for merger?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know his and Lucy's relationship that well. I know he was very, very close to Lucy, and probably planted the idea originally, but I'm not sure. I don't know that well, but Lucy certainly picked it up and carried it through himself, and if there wasn't any question about it, he carried it through the legislature. One by one vote, as I recall, in the Senate, I think it was one vote. And the university regents were convinced it was not going to pass. Right up the meeting before the vote was taken, in fact.
What, do you remember the day when that happened? I mean,
well, it was, I think at the, it was, the regents talked about it at a meeting in Racine. I think it was the Wingspread. I think the meeting was held at the Wingspread, actually. And talked about it, and felt that they did not have to get into the game, because it was going to be voted down. And so it was decided that they would not aggressively campaign in the Senate in opposition to it. So that they thought it would hurt some of their other things. If they were almost entirely, if not all, and were opposed to merger.
Yes.
I think it was probably unanimous. I don't remember anybody in the board supporting it.
But you know, you say you think it's worked out on the whole.
Yes.
Do you think it's been more costly than the former system, way of the
no, I think it saved money.
You do?
I think it saved money because even despite the fact of approving two doctoral programs in nursing this past year, that a lot of academic program duplication has been either eliminated or forestalled. Probably more of the forestalling of it, and not even at the board level. They never got to the board. That system administration has taken a pretty firm hand in certain areas, and has just turned thumbs down on even allowing the institutions to come forward with recommendations for programs which are already in existence at some other institutions in the system. And I guess I think that if it hadn't been for merger, there would have been other institutions in the system giving doctorate degrees besides Madison and Milwaukee. There would have been so much pressure from an institution like Eau Claire, which is off a long ways from Madison and Milwaukee, and it could have gotten a lot of political support from that whole part of the state. And my feeling is that if it hadn't been for merger, Eau Claire and maybe some of the others as well would have had doctoral programs, and which are costly programs. And so I think that overall that it has saved money. The administration, I think, overall, by and large, has been kept pretty much to a minimum. I don't think you would have had any fewer dollars spent if you would have gone the other way. Probably, we did eliminate the coordinating council. That whole budget was eliminated, and the same amount of money wasn't put into the administration.
Hmm.
So that was really pretty much a pure savings there. A lot of that was a pure savings. And, yes, I think it's worked out pretty well. I think Madison being part of the system when they were really in the doghouse there for the first part of the 70s, at least when they were really in the doghouse, that they probably came out better than they would have if they would have been on their own, because people were really pretty unhappy about them. One of the things which should have been done and has never been done, I think, is to give the regions more flexibility in the setting of fees and using the fees for budgetary purposes, similar to that which is true in most every other major institution, like Indiana and Purdue and Michigan and all the rest of them. Have quite a bit of flexibility.
Are you talking about tuition or
fees? And tuition. Fees and tuition. Mm. Yeah, both the in-state and, normally the fees are the in-state students and the tuition is a differential for the out-of-state students. Mm. It's a distinction between fees and tuition.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, tuition is the out-of-state portion.
Yeah,
of
I see.
Normally we refer that to that as tuition. But see, your undergraduates are already paying more than 100% of costs. So that's undergraduate non-residents pay more than 100% of costs this year and did last year. So hard to raise that very much higher.
This used to be in the hands of the regents, but was taken over by the
legislature. No, the regents have never really had that power. No.
Way back in the early 50s?
No.
I thought when Kohler was governor.
Well, Kohler cut the budget. You know, that was a very substantial budget reduction in 1953, and that was a. Was it?
But I'm thinking of something Young said, Bill Young, and he said you, and Cafferty and he.
Mm-hmm.
Felt that. If the state was going to include student fees in the budget, that then the state ought to be responsible for determining student fees in order not to, and I didn't quite understand what the point was. But.
Yeah, well, that's the way it's worked, and that is the way it has worked, that the state pools the money, the appropriation and the student fees.
Mm-hmm.
And
but doesn't it also set the student?
It doesn't set the student fees.
The regents do that.
The regents set the fees, but the state sets the amount of money that you can use from fees. The state says, now it says that you've got $180 million of fee income, that's all you can use. And then the regents determine how much of it's paid by residents and non-residents and graduates and undergraduates and so on. The split of the pot is done by the regents, but the overall total is done by the state. And what Bill is really saying, that since they determine that pot, then in effect that they are setting the fees as well, because they said that you will charge, there was an, it's not in the statutes any place, but it was well understood back at that time that the students paid 20% of the cost of instruction. The resident undergraduate paid 20% of the cost of instruction. And then that's gone up now. Now they're paying right around 30% now. And it'll probably go higher. But what I'm saying is that the regents should have flexibility over and above that. That instead of saying it's $180 million is all you can get from fee income, if the regents wanted to, they should be able to say, we want to do some things here, and it's going to cost us another $10 million. And so they should have flexibility to do that, which they do in other states. And they take the other states, they have a portion of it which is used to pay for the operating costs, but then the regents can always add to that as long as it's within reason. So we don't have that flexibility in Wisconsin, and I think that is a shortcoming here. The disadvantage of doing it that way is that the regents this year say we'll go up to $190 million fee income, then the legislature comes back in session, and they'll just sweep that in and cut the state portion of it that much. And that's the real danger. And that was one of Bill's concerns as well, that if you do have that flexibility, you have the danger of losing it as well at the next go-around. Bill Young and Neil Caffrey and I did a lot of budget discussions and so on, and Bill was our liaison with the legislature and extremely effective, and got to know those people very well.
I'd like to ask you about all of that, but he said to talk to you about your developing a doing research on, I think I'll turn the tape. I've got the specific wording. They were experiments in costing, in how much instruction cost, and in the enrollment funding formula.
Is it?
It's on.
The enrollment funding formula, I think, was used mostly after merger to use it as a tool in measuring the cost effectiveness of the operations of the different institutions, and then making the awards of the enrollment funding to those institutions. It is a very complicated formula, and I still think it's a very good formula. Some people try to tear down its credibility periodically when they're in the short end of it, but I think President O'Neill is not a strong supporter of it, but I haven't seen anything come along that's any better. It takes into consideration the levels of students by freshmen, sophomores, juniors and seniors, masters, and PhD, those four levels. It takes into consideration the disciplines, the six major discipline groupings. One of them is health sciences, and the social sciences, and humanities, and the physical sciences, and engineering. There's a breakdown of six of them, and these are then costed out, take an average cost for each of the disciplines by level, and then you weight it all by the number of students in those areas. You also crank in a factor for part-time extended day students, because generally those are more expensive because your class sizes are smaller. And so that's a factor is considered in it. You also add into it a element for academic support. That's for libraries and computing services particularly. And you add another factor in there for student services. And these are all formalized and based upon history and so on, but are then applied uniformly to the various institutions across the system. The student services, for instance, is based upon headcount of students. And the academic support is based upon several different indexes to arrive at the figure for that. So it's a very complicated setup, but it does attempt to recognize most of the factors of cost differentials. And then you work from a base on it, you know, that, say Milwaukee is 52 and Madison might be 53 or something like that. And then you convert that, eventually convert it back into $2, but you develop an index, a relative index. And it's not a set dollar amount you come up, but you come up with a relative index on it. And then you use that and apply it towards available resources and make your allocations. It is one of the tools that were used in making the allocations.
So what's the history of it? How did it come about?
Well, it came about because of the need for some fairly sophisticated method of determining how the funding for institutions related to their output. I mean, are you funding Eau Claire comparably to La Crosse? Mm-hmm. Or the doctoral institutions were never in the same index as a non-doctoral because they were because of the high cost of the PhD programs. So those two were kept separate, but they were still, you know, you looked at them in relationship to the others, that they stayed there. Relative position would stay pretty much constant from year to year. So it was developed in an attempt to be of great assistance in determining the funding level for the various institutions.
Well, I mean, did you develop it?
Don Percy had a lot to do with it. Don Percy, Elwin Kamek also had a lot to do with it, and I worked on it. Elwin Kamek probably deserves as much credit as anybody for that.
Who's this?
Elwin Kamek, who is in charge of institutional research.
Hmm.
And he's also in charge of the system data bank. And see, most of the information could be taken out of the after we developed the data bank, you could get this information out of it. So uh-huh. It was just a matter then of compiling it and putting it together. And so the legislature recognized it to the point that no institution should be more than 30% off from the mean. And Superior was over that for a while, so was pretty well mandated that we cut the heck out of their budget, and it took out about $1,200,000 out of their budget over a two-year period. That's a lot of money from a relatively small institution like that, so it was a major, major reduction to bring them within the range here of the composite support index is what it's called. It's a CSI.
Oh, I see.
And so it's a composite support index of all of the institutions. And I think it's a very good formula, and I don't think anybody's come up with anything any better yet. Other institutions around the country have used it in their own format, but most of them have felt it's too complicated, and they don't have enough information in their database to really do it effectively.
Have you gone around giving talks on it?
Some, yes. We've done some on it, yes, and a couple of times. People, and we've given them information. Georgia, for instance, is one of them, and Illinois, and some of the rest of them have asked for it. We've sent them the written materials and so on.
So you essentially became the person who had to get the data for it.
The data came out of data came from a variety of sources. A portion of it came right out of the financial documents, which I was, of course, responsible for. Portion of it came out of the student records, the enrollment records, and so on, which were in the database on their Elwin's shop. And then part of it was the budget information. So you put it all, melded it all together, and come up with the various figures on it. Once you get the program set up, the model set up, and so on, it's relatively easy to do it, to change it. And then for the future, we always did our enrollment projections. And by doing enrollment projections, then you could always extrapolate into the future what the relative position would be with different types of funding. Now, if you took $300,000 away from Oshkosh and gave it to La Crosse, what would this do to it? So, which the type of thing which we use it for.
Yeah.
We took a lot of money away from Oshkosh and gave it to some of the other institutions.
And where did was this decision made to do that? In your office or among?
It was among. It was always among the...
You and the other vice presidents?
Right, and the president. Oh. And this was always reviewed at the vice president and presidential level. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so we had them very good. The relative positions were really working out very well. And then now Stevens Point enrollment hasn't kept pace with some of the rest of them, so Stevens Point's falling out of the norm now. So as the enrollments change, now Whitewater enrollment's going up faster than a lot of the rest of them, so they've dropped down in the relative funding position per student.
Can you predict the enrollment at each institution
well? We do that, of course, and some of the regions actually wanted us to predict it by discipline, but that never worked out very well. You can do it for next year or 2 years maybe, but you go beyond that, you know what's happening in engineering. Engineering goes like a yo-yo.
Yes.
Some of the others do the same thing. So it hasn't been very good to work it out by discipline very far in the future.
Was this affected by the affirmative action effort to get more money for women and more?
No, actually the affirmative action funding is so small in relationship to the total budgets that is as far as the employment situation is concerned. I mean, the equity adjustments or whatever they were really are relatively insignificant.
So when that big push came, when Serena Ponderon was in the chancellor's office, and that was just a little flurry in your office.
Right, yeah. Huh. Yeah, pretty much so, yeah. Yeah. When you look at the big picture, the affirmative action money for students is more obvious, I guess, the impact of that, and the whole student financial aid program is more obvious because it's a big chunk of money going into there. I'm sure there is a lot of money going into affirmative action and the result of affirmative action, but most of that was money that probably should have been spent a long time ago, so it permanently, it just becomes part of your permanent budget base. So it doesn't stand out like the money which is set aside specifically for minority and disadvantaged students. That's set out separately.
I've heard that at one time, this was in the early 70s, the Madison campus, administrative data, ADP?
Administrative data processing?
Yes. Couldn't get material from the central. This from the system.
Well, I think it's more the other way around.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it was more the other way around.
Well, maybe that.
That there were requests for information more probably from the state level than the federal level of EEOC requirements, and there was a feeling in Madison that. The Privacy Information Act precluded them from giving out certain types of information, and they did give out to, say, a federal agency, and they couldn't understand why that couldn't suffice for the state agencies as well. And so there was, other institutions in the system were willing to give it, and so on. So at Madison, there was
this. I thought it was a question of rivalry between the two, the academic data processing.
No. It was more serious than that. Mm. It was not between the data processing people. It was more between, particularly Serena Pondrum and probably Marion Svoboda, who's in charge of the system level, this type of thing. That there was a certain rivalry, jealousy, whatever you call it, between the people that were in charge of the programs, not at the data processing level, but at the higher level than that. No, I don't think we'd have any problem with the data processing. They'll do what whatever the executive level tells them to do. I mean, so it was at a higher level than that. I think it's finally fairly good shape now, but it's been simmering all for the last ever since 12, 13 years now since affirmative action really, I guess it goes back earlier than that even, because I think it goes back into the late 60s.
This rivalry, you mean, between the Madison and the,
and the
Central.
And the information that should be released relating to affirmative action. Mm. I think it's resolved now that that they've agreed on what their both sides are going to provide, and I think they've pretty well talked the state into accepting the submissions to the feds. And then, but you know, it's not only between Madison and the system, but it's between the state and the system and the state and Madison, because the state has been, I think, unreasonable in some of their positions on that. They would not accept the information which was given to other people. Well, you just something you just can't go and reconstruct that information that easily if it's some new piece of data that they want. And and of course you're prohibited from asking so many questions too. And
what do you mean?
Well, in interviews, you know, whether you're an Indian or a black or whatever
see.
The
yes,
case
okay.
may be. I mean,
yeah.
And a lot of those things you couldn't ask. And, you know, it's not always obvious whether you're a minority or not.
When O'Neill started, did he, you say that Weaver and Don Smith and Don Percy were a triumvirate. Did O'Neill run things differently?
Well, Ed Young did too.
Oh, that's right, Ed Young. Excuse me, of course,
there.
He was there for 74 to...
And 70...
70, yeah, that's right.
And Ed Young had a larger cabinet and met regularly. I think we met weekly.
Mm-hmm. Which, and you were consisted of?
President and the vice president and some of the associate vice presidents and legal counsel.
So that was rather a big group then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So not terribly effective, presumably.
It was 10 people or something like that. Mm. And O'Neill has continued that, and as you say, it's too large a group to be completely effective. But all policy decisions are cleared through that group before they go forward.
All right.
Yeah, it's not uncommon at the policy group to have 15 or 16 people in attendance, and I say it's too large to be a working group. But all policies do get cleared through there, and so if you have something which is more controversial and this type of thing, you generally try to work it out ahead of time, so you come in with just a way of proposing
it. Work it out with the people that are going to oppose it, you mean? Or
well, that so that you people who are going to be affected will be all on board pretty much before you go into it. Rather than to involve a large group like that into a debate between a couple of people, you try to get it pretty well settled. And of course, the president uses it as a sounding board for some of his ideas and so on, and so that's helpful, I think. Then, of course, the monthly meetings with the chancellors. The president meets with the chancellor, the president and vice president meets with the chancellors each month. And that's a expensive meeting, and just like the regent meetings are very expensive meetings, they have all the chancellors come in and spend 2 days at a regent meeting every month.
2 days at a regent meeting?
Yeah, the regent meetings are Thursday and Friday.
And the chancellors come to attend
days.
Them both, once a month?
Yeah, both days. And, sit through them, and then you have your system staff. There's always 8 or 9 private people from there in attendance, and so you have a tremendous amount of salary costs associated with each board meeting. The chancellors, even though they may sit there for a year and never get called upon, at least some of them feel it's quite important for them to be there, just to have a sense of the board. And there's some logic to that, if you remove yourself from the discussions and so on, it's hard to imagine exactly which direction they're heading in. So it's very helpful, I think, for them to be there. But it is driving down from, even Eau Claire and Stout and River Falls, it's a long haul. And the planes have become so expensive and almost unreliable. Now these small feeder ones have been unreliable, so that most of them have gone to driving again now. The vice chancellors also meet, I think, about half a dozen times a year, and the academic staff has a group that meet. And, faculty, the various elected faculty representatives on each campus get together, and like Madison, the chairman of the university committee, and then each of the campus has something similar to the university committee, and so they meet on a regular basis as well. And they also meet with the vice president for academic affairs, and of course, I told you earlier, the business people meet, and there's a lot of different groups meet, so try and have as much consistency and coordination throughout the system. And, the risk managers meet, and the student affairs people meet, and so I think by and large that there is general uniformity in most practices, both academic and business, throughout the system. I think it's working pretty well. I don't know of anything else that can really comes to mind on the relationship of merger and the system and how it's getting along now. I have some other areas here which maybe
yes.
We don't have much time left.
Well, shall we call this a session then?
Maybe so.
All right, let's do that.